thank you very much for the people that actually got out of bed this early in the morning. I'm going back to bed right after my talk. It's a very great pleasure to be here and speak in this symposium in honor of Wendell, who many of us have known for a number of years and greatly admire. This has nothing to do with my talk at all. For those of you who know what I do, I work on mate choice and, of course, in chemical ecology, and we're interested to know how chemical ecology plays a role when you make the wrong choice, and that is one part of it. But today I was asked to talk about the other section of the research that I do in my laboratory that relates with insect migration. And I should say this is sort of, I backed into insect migration by mistake, and it was at this point in time that I actually established contact with Wendell. And I should explain that many years ago I used to work on this insect that you see up here called the European skipper, and we were interested, it was an introduced species, was a problem, and we discovered there was a nuclear polyhedrosis virus, and so we had scooped up thousands of larvae, crushed them up, and we were going to actually test them. And I'd hired three summer students, and this outbreak of the worms you see on your bottom right, the army worm, came in and ate my entire plot. And as I had nothing to do, I thought, well, I might as well work on this caterpillar because it's here and I've got three students. And it turned out to be the army worm. And at that point in time with Ada Hill, Wendell had actually identified the sex pheromone and asked me if we would run some field trials in Canada to find out whether it was very effective. And it turned out to be quite effective. And we actually ran a whole series of experiments. That's sort of Jean Toljean in the background, who ended up working with Wendell, and I and Jean decided to do his PhD on it. And because Wendell had identified the sex pheromone, we started looking at the calling behavior. And also, when Charlie will recognize this as the old wind tunnel, I didn't have one, so Jean Toljean went down to Wendell's to actually do the research on the male responsiveness. And while he was there, obviously, I went down every so often. And Wendell was a young man, and of course, he was very keen on the chemistry and was very into it. And at that point in time, he would love to sit and natter. And I once said to him, you know, this is really exciting. I've just backed into chemical ecology. But as a field ecologist, I'm interested in the effect of diet. At which point, he just burst out laughing, leapt up and down, and said, my God, we've got another Hendry. And I said, no, just wait a minute. There are things about this. As a chemist, you see the world one way, I see it another. You see it molecularly, the structures are all there, they all look the same, but I look from the other side, and it isn't the same. And so, depending on the condition that one is in, one has a very different view ecologically. So I told him that, like it or not, I was going to continue working on the army worm. And we've stayed friends ever since. And Paul Fields, one of my graduate students, had a thesis that was to look at the overwintering of the army worm, and of course he discovered within about 3 months the army worm dies. And he wanted his PhD, we wouldn't give it to him, but we decided, well, if this is the case, clearly this is either an insect that flies in, dies, and that's the end of it, or it is a return migrant. Well, one of my colleagues said, it's easy, I work on geese, you just put bands on them and people shoot them at the other end and you know exactly where they went. And I said, well, people squash insects, but A, we can't band them very well, and people don't care about them, particularly as mine fly at night, they go up in the air, you can't see them. So I thought we must find some other way. And I was reading a book, because I also work on diapause, and Tauber et al. Came up with this model of seasonally unpredictable habitat change. And if you're looking at the predictable, and that's what we're going to start off with, the one thing is number four was the altered behavior, and the number one with the neuroendocrine changes. So we thought, well, given as we're working on the calling behavior and male responsiveness, can we actually use this to get a handle on the migration? Does it migrate or not? Well, using light traps and pheromone traps, we went out and we started trapping, and if we look at the female responses, when we were catching them in the summer, greater than 95% of them were mated based on the presence of a spermatophore that you see in the bottom right, and the ovaries were well developed, very little fat body. Whereas when you went into the fall, greater than 97% of them were sexually immature, they had masses of fat. So we're going, okay, this is a change as would be predicted in adult reproductive diapause, And then when we looked at the males, you could see that in the summertime, we caught males in both the light traps and the pheromone traps. And when you had big trap catches in the light trap, you had big catches in the pheromone traps. In the fall, we caught lots of males in the light traps, but we caught very few males in the pheromone traps. So we were in a situation where we had females do not become sexually mature, males do not respond. So we were doing the pre-reproductive, it's called the oogenesis flight syndrome, whereby the individuals in response to abiotic cues of day length and temperature would delay the onset of reproduction, theoretically migrate out. Well, we tested it in the lab, and Joanne Delisle was with her work. You can see that even at 25 degrees, 16 hours light, which is summer conditions, they didn't reproduce until about 6 days after emergence. Well, I actually wrote a paper and proposed that unlike non-migrants, which become sexually mature within 24 hours, this idea that even under ideal conditions, there is a delay in the onset of reproduction may be a life history trait that one could use to identify migrant moths. And you can see at 10 degrees short days, they delay till 21 days after emergence, which we believe is the window that allows them to either acquire the resources to be able to migrate and have the time to get the heck out of Quebec or northern Ontario and get down south in time. Similarly, when we looked at the males at 25 degrees summer conditions, greater than 70% of the males of 5 days old would fly up to the pheromone source, whereas at 10 degrees, 12 hours light, and we did, that's what they were reared under, but we tested them at 20 degrees immediately, so they could fly. Less than 10% of them would reach the source even at 25 days old. So we believed that they were migrants, and we then came up with the idea if juvenile hormone would be involved, and this is Michel Cousin's work, who we knew that juvenile hormone was involved in ovarian development. The question was it involved in the production of pheromone? And Michel did some extremely elegant experiments looking at the role of juvenile hormone by actually removing the corpora lata, gluing the females' heads back together on the day of emergence, and clearly showed that without juvenile hormone, they did not become sexually mature, they did not develop ovaries at all, but they did not produce pheromone. We could do rescue experiments and so on and so forth. And then we looked at the idea going on Rankin and Ridderford's model that you actually have a low threshold of juvenile hormone when it's poor quality habitat, and at that low level they will exhibit migratory behavior, whereas at a high level of juvenile hormone in a good habitat they will produce their ovaries and will reproduce in situ. Well, we did the actual juvenile hormone biosynthesis, and you can see they fit the model very well. And so we now believe that this is the working model for armyworms and other migrants that are migrating in response to predictable habitat change. I actually wanted to prove it, so I went off into the Pyrenees and the Alps, and this is the Col de Glandon in the Alps, and this is where the crazy people on the Tour de France cycle up. It is really scary, but this is where you stand on top of a mountain, and that is axis. We are looking north there, and it's going south. So we got up there, and we had intercept traps like this with the idea, and I should show you the next slide. So one is facing the north on your left-hand side. The one on the right is facing south, and we had pheromone traps and light traps. Prediction, they would be moving south. They would be sexually immature. I'm very happy to say I got 100% proof. I got one individual, she was sexually immature and she was heading south. It didn't publish, they refused it for some unknown reason. But when I was there, there was a young man working at the same laboratory who came from the Azores. And he said, oh, we have armyworms in the Azores. So I thought, well, I've never been there, so why not go? And it turned out to be a magnificent place. And they have masses of armyworms, but they don't migrate. Why would you migrate? You're in the middle of nowhere. It's because if you don't know where the Azores are, they're sort of the Hawaiian equivalent in the Atlantic Ocean. But as you can see here, there are very marked differences. Although the ones in the Azores are migrants that were blown off, they are now, they take much shorter developmental time, they're smaller, they have smaller wings. You can see that they become sexually mature much more quickly. They haven't got to day one, but they're down to day three, and we have shown that we can do selection experiments and get results like this. So we're now, where this is a system we're working on, looking at, I have graduate students looking at muscle structure and flight performance in response to this. But I want to show you a couple of others where we actually were looking at pheromone chemical ecology, and this is work that I did with Dorothy Pashley, who was the one that showed that there are two host strains of the fall armyworm. And we looked at the calling behavior, because there's a rice strain and a corn strain, and the one thing that you can see, although they are morphologically very similar, they actually respond differently to temperature and photoperiodic conditions, with the corn ones actually delaying considerably more than the rice strain, and we've repeated this a number of times. So the question arises in this case, we know they migrate north and south. The question is, who migrates where? Are the rice ones tropical, subtropical? Are the corn ones subtropical, temperate? What happens to the hybrids and so on and so forth? If any of there's a graduate student out there that wants to look at this, I think it would be an amazing system. We also looked at the Black Army cutworm, which again is a sporadic pest, and the larvae eat anything in sight, but they were known to be attracted to fires. So we asked the question, does the odor from a burnt forest actually work as an attractant? And this is sort of the opposite of what normal people do in a wind tunnel. We were actually flying females up to smoke. And you can see here that even on the day of emergence, more than about 40% of the females will actually fly upwind, just like a male to a pheromone, in a smoke plume. And it isn't the heat, they are responding to the chemicals. The other thing is, so this is a releaser. You also have a primer pheromone, and this was done by Claude Everatz. And you can see that when they have the duff, and we worked with fire ecologists, and we found out that the fresh ash, if you put them with the odor of burnt vegetation, they become sexually mature about 7 days after emergence, as opposed to 13 if it's unburned. But the odor dissipates, and the next year, that site where they actually develop will then be no longer attractive, so they migrate back, they move on somewhere else. And why would they track fires? Enemy-free space, probably. And also, the vegetation that grows is very rich and low in chemical defenses. But basically, they're from dead wood, so we call them pheromones because we don't know what they are. And these are the compounds that the antennae can actually detect, but we don't know which ones are the releasers and which ones are the primers. We also did one in unpredictable habitat as well with the sunflower moth, and we knew that this is attracted to pollen, and they actually use pollen cues to lay their eggs. Steve Foster is working on this right now with Stefan Schultz and I. But we were interested to see whether it affected sexual maturation, the presence or absence of pollen. And as you can see here, yes, it does. If pollen is present, they become sexually mature within 3 days. And if they don't, then they delay. And what we think is happening, if on your left, if there are flowers in the right phenological state, i.e. there is a presence of pollen, they will become sexually mature quickly, lay their eggs, profit from the habitat. On the other hand, if in the right, if they are flying around, there is no pollen, then they will immediately delay the onset of reproduction and migrate in any direction looking for suitable hosts. But this is for Wendell to remind him that ecology is important. If you do this experiment, regardless of the temperature, under short and long days, you get remarkably different responses. The right-hand side is what I showed you earlier, where it's greater than 6 days if there's no pollen, and less than 3 days if there is pollen. If you do it under short days, the pollen cue really isn't important at all, which makes sense because they have to actually lay their eggs and get to the pupal stage to be able to overwinter. But in the last little bit, I would like to talk to you about an ongoing one, and this is migration of the monarch butterfly. And of course, everybody knows about this. They leave the Canada and the northern states, the eastern population, and go down to Mexico. Most amazing sight. If you haven't been, I would recommend it. It's an entomological wonder. There are a million butterflies probably sitting on that tree. And I was called by a guy called Barry Frost, who actually is a psychologist who works on orientation and wants to work on bird migration, but he decided to practice on butterflies. And he actually worked out that he called me and he said, I've worked out how they orient. They head southwest using sun compass. And I know they're better than the Brits because they don't head off into the channel to make telephone calls. But I have a question for you. How do they know when to stop? You know that it's southwest, but when do you stop? So we started talking about the possibilities, and I said, well, you know, there might be visual cues. They know where they are, and if you've ever been in the area, there are lots of visual cues. Even the bikers tell you all about monarchs. But we decided that probably if there was a cue, it would be a chemical cue that was left by the individuals because they go back to the same areas every year and will sit on the tree for weeks, weeks, weeks at a time, leaving and coming back to the same trees in extremely high numbers. And so we believe that either through their feet or through defecation or both, they may be leaving a chemical message. Of course, the question is then, where would it come from? Parsimoniously, one could think about, okay, cardiac glycosides, which they acquire as adults, may be a precursor or maybe the base compound itself. The other, of course, are the pyrrolizidine alkaloids that both sexes can detect and pick up as adults on the migration down. So, yes, it would be parsimoniously good if they stayed there, left the message, to use something that both sexes can recognize and already use in their life histories. Then, of course, you get this question. What happens? They leave and it rains. What if it gets washed away? Well, we started thinking about that, and then I actually, despite being old, I had this flash about some experiments I did back in the 70s when we were looking at, I was actually looking at ants, but and the top right there, you have the jackpine sawfly, and we were looking at that, but at the same area, they were spraying phenotrophion against the spruce budworm. And we were finding that our jackpine sawfly were dying even though they'd told us they hadn't sprayed that year. And making a long story short, it turns out that phenotrophion sorbs into the waxes of the needles and stays there and does not get broken down. And if there's 3 years spraying, then the first year will have X, the second year growth will have X plus Y, the third year growth will have X plus Y plus. So you have this accumulation. Well, what do monarchs sit on? They sit on firs, they sit on trees that keep their needles. So yes, it could stay there. If they left the message, it would persist over time. And when you have that many butterflies sitting there, we reckon it would be a reasonable cue. But that's where they live. How would you know? Well, if you ever watch the butterflies, when they fly in over the hills, they go around like this, over the top. And so we're looking at it, and then we're thinking, wait a minute. You go out in the morning and it's extremely cold and then the sun hits and it warms up remarkably. Well, what we think may be happening is that you end up with a system like this, where as it goes up, thermals are rising, the chemical cues would be there, the insects fly around, pick it up, and then will go down. We now think as well, there may be a visual cue as well, because if you look, that's a newly emerged butterfly, and the older ones here down at the overwintering site, the wings pale. And we have shown that there is a change in the UV reflectance. So we are thinking that maybe when they get over the top circle and go down, if there are butterflies already there, there are some opening and closing their wings, and this may be a visual cue that goes along with the chemical cue. Well, all my life I've been accused of being a hand waver, and people say, okay, fine, prove it. Do we have any actual data that might support it? Well, we've been down there and we've collected branches where the butterflies were on a sunny day. We shook them off so they could fly somewhere else. And we have extracted the waxes. And we have done two series of preliminary experiments. The clothesline on your left, where we took branches from a site where they don't overwinter on the fir trees. And we painted them either with wax extract from the sites where they actually did roost and from control sites, and we only had 21 butterflies sit on them because I was an idiot and put them in the shade instead of out in the sun. But of the 21, 18 of them sat on the foliage that had been treated with wax extracts from a roosting site, and only 3 on the control site. Barry had modified his flight mill where the insects can fly in circles, but they can turn around and fly back again. And in the preliminary experiments, again, I gave him 2 extracts, A and B, and he said, they would fly, and then they would spin around one, they'd fly away, spin a little bit, go back and do a lot more, and thank goodness they actually knew which one was from the extract of the Omelia fur. So we have preliminary data, and if NSERC is kind enough to give us the money, we will continue this work and we'll see how it's going. In this one we have Isabella, who is our contact in Mexico, reading Link Brower's head. He actually has a GPS system, and he was so proud of it, we had to stop every 20 minutes to see if we were in the right place. Vitko Franco, who unfortunately cannot join us, is working on the chemistry, and Lester Wadhams at the bottom is helping with the neurophysiology and the airborne collections that we're doing. So, in closing, thank you, Wendell, for the friendship, the crap you've given me over the years. It's been a lot of fun, and now that you are retiring, enjoy it. Thank you very much indeed.